We're going to deviate a bit from the agenda here and move Dr. Wirth's presentation up. Dr. Wirth, welcome.
Let me get rid of this stuff here. Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to present what is my annual presentation to the Commission on issues related to emerging aquatic vegetation. I normally make this presentation in the fall, but because your agendas for the fall were really full, and I had some conflicts with some things I was doing that we never had the opportunity to do this. So this is a little bit late, but better late than never, and I've added some information that is very appropriate to the discussion to my presentation today. So I think it will be very enlightening, especially because of the issues related to the blue crab. So I know there are some new members, and so part of the discussions or presentation will be some background material so you know where I'm coming from. And so I apologize for those that have been here that if you've heard some of this, some of the graphics will be the same. But for the new members that weren't here in December of 2012, there's going to be some background. And I'll tell you what, if I could just have a dimming of the lights, because some of the graphics I think will be more appropriate when there's not a lot of light shining on it. Okay, so these are the topics that I'll be covering for today. First, I'll be talking about the bay-wide status of submerged aquatic vegetation to you, and also what we see as an emerging story on eelgrass, which is the dominant species in the lower bay. We'll talk about the Chincoteague SAV sanctuary, some propeller scarring issue, aquaculture issues. The big topic, which I always end up with, is our seagrass restoration on the seaside, and then a few actions here. But with some background for some of you, why is there so much emphasis on submerged aquatic vegetation? Again, these are plants that live underwater. Well, these plants are very, very sensitive to light, and light is a huge issue in the Chesapeake Bay right now, especially with the Bay Program and EPA trying to improve water quality. So we're using these underwater plants as sort of a biological sentinel because they respond very quickly to light, and they're being used as one of the major indicators by managers to assess the effectiveness of the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay. And in this light, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, along with the state of Maryland, believe it or not, put in their the acreages of submerged aquatic vegetation in different segments of the bay as a way of determining the importance of water clarity. So in this document, you're going to actually have how many acres of submerged aquatic vegetation is necessary to improve for the attainment of the water quality standards. So what I basically say is that for Chesapeake Bay and for these water quality standards, literally every acre of underwater grasses really counts. So let's first of all launch into the bay-wide status. And again, for those of you that haven't heard this, VIMS has a responsibility for mapping these underwater grass beds every single year. And these are from aerial photographs. And these are the flight lines that we fly every year. We have an aerial contractor that flies out of Martinsburg, West Virginia, and collects aerial photographs. These are vertical aerial photographs that we then, you know, provide information from. And this is these are data that come from just us spending an awful lot of time looking at a lot of aerial photographs. And what we do is fly at a certain altitude under certain tidal conditions with the right sun angle and minimal clouds and wind to get optimal photography, because it's really important that we actually see every single grass bed. Our goal is to basically keep our fingers on the pulse of where every single grass bed is, because it's really important to the bay. So with that, what's happening with underwater grasses? Well, since we started an annual monitoring, here you're looking at the number of acres of underwater vegetation for the entire Chesapeake Bay. This is not just Virginia. It's the total bay and all the tributaries. And your eye picks up that, yeah, things were doing really well through the 90s into 2000, and they kind of go up and down. Here are the numbers for 2012. We had a pretty bad year in 2012. Now, again, these are 2012 numbers. We do not have the 2013 numbers because we're certainly processing that data. We present that data to EPA and all of the partners that provide funding effective March 1st. So when I make a presentation to you, hopefully in the fall, I will have the 2013 numbers. But for 2012, we saw a significant decline in the amount of bay grasses. Now, part of this was related to the fact, if you recall, in 2011, in August and September, we had two major storms, Tropical Storm Lee and was it Tropical Storm Irene and then Hurricane Lee. And these two storms dumped a huge amount of water and resulted in a lot of turbidity, sediment coming into the bay. And we think the downfall of some of the bay grasses was related to that. And so if you look at that number along here, that was one of the lowest numbers of total SAV that we had in the bay. Now, the bay program and the states have agreed that they want to restore underwater grasses, and so they have a goal set up of around 185,000 acres. And here we are at only about 50,000. So we are a long, long way from attaining the goal the bay program would like for Chesapeake Bay. And so the 2012 total, we're only at 26% of the restoration goal that the Chesapeake Bay program would like to have. Let me give you some highlights of what's happening for the underwater grasses based on where they are in the bay. So we're looking at the fact that in the low salinity areas around this part of the bay, things were doing really, really well up until 2010, and then this big decline, of course, because of the fact that Irene and Lee dumped a lot of fresh water. We lost a lot of the freshwater grasses. The middle part of the bay here, which is this big, big green area, have been kind of bouncing around. Not a lot of changes, although we certainly have had a lot more than when we had when we first started monitoring in 1984. The lower bay or high salinity area, which is something that is very relevant to you all and which I'm going to highlight in a few slides later on, is that things were doing really well up until the early 90s. And since then, we've had a lot of cyclic issues where sometimes it goes down or goes up. But the overall trend in the lower bay has been a downward spiral. And I'll highlight those that aspect in my next few slides. So for us in the lower bay, this is becoming an issue. Now, just to give you a highlight of what's happening in a couple of sections, and if I remember, if you remember that slide, there was a couple of boxes. Segment MOBPH is the Mobjack Bay. And here's what's been happening with eelgrass in the Mobjack Bay. And here we are in 2012. If you compare that number to where we were when we first started monitoring, the amount of bay grasses in the Mobjack Bay is less than what we had way back then. Even though there was a large increase going through the mid-90s, there's been a downward trend, which, again, I'll highlight more appropriately in the next few slides. However, there have been a positive benefit, and this is freshwater grasses in the James River, and we're actually doing quite well in this particular segment. Now, the goal is 1,333 acres. We are kind of getting close to it, depending on how it turns out in 2013. So there are some good sides to the story, but there are also lots of downsides. Okay, so this is the part that I really want to key in on because this is really relevant to a lot of the discussions that you're going to have when it relates to the blue crab. So what about eelgrass? Now, eelgrass is one of two species that occur in the lower bay. It's a true seagrass. It doesn't like fresh water. And what I want to do is let's look at what's happening with eelgrass in these three particular areas. We're calling these Tangier because of the relevance of underwater grasses to Tangier because of all of the crab scraping that goes on up there. We're calling this Lower Eastern Shore, which is a large area from Great Fox and the Pocomokes down all the way down to Cape Charles. And then the Lower Western Shore, which incorporates a large amount of the grasses in the lower bay, which includes the Mobjack Bay and the Pocosin Flats. These red dots represent water quality monitoring stations that where monthly to semi-monthly cruisers go out and collect lots of water quality data. So I'm going to show you what's been happening with eelgrass in each of these three segments and relate that to what's happening with water clarity. So pay particular attention to this, and I'll try to walk you through the slides because there's a lot of data in the next few slides. But again, this is incredibly relevant and of a major concern to us who are watching what's happening with bay grasses. So first, let me talk about, again, remember those three sections, Lower Western Shore, Lower Eastern Shore, and Tangier. Here's what's been happening with looking at the total amount of bay grasses in each of these segments. So here's Lower Western Shore, and here we have this increase and a dramatic drop through about 2005, an increase, and then another drop, you know, through 2012. And that same pattern you see in each of these three areas. So we're looking at, when we compare to where we were in 84 to where we are today, we're having much less grass relevant to, you know, for example, blue crab habitat in 2012 than what we had in 1984, even though we were very optimistic when we saw this big increase. Now, the next set of slides, let me take a few minutes to walk you through this. Here are, again, the three sections, Lower Eastern Shore, Lower Western Shore, and Tangier. And we took all that mapping data and we lumped all that and then overlaid bathymetry, because you know, you want grasses to occur as deep as you can. So we took the bathymetry, overlaid in a GIS system where our grasses were. And so what you have here are three depth zones. We call deep, which is a dark blue line, the middle area, so there's depths of 0 to 0.5, and shallow, which is really the inner edge. And remembering that our bathymetry is based on some crude way of collecting, so sometimes boats that are collecting bathymetry data can't get into water that's less than half a meter. But what I want to highlight is, look what is happening to grasses in the deep section. It's going up, 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 and then all of a sudden down in each of these segments. And look at Tangier, and in particular the Lower Western Shore. We are essentially losing all of our bay grasses in the deep sections of the Lower Chesapeake Bay. And why? Well, here's what's happening. Let's look at the water quality, water clarity, that is collected from these stations that I highlighted in that graphic in those little red dots. And water clarity is collected with a Secchi disc. It's a little black and white disc that's lower through the water. And when you see it disappear, that is where people record the amount of light. So what you see and what disappears at a point where you can't see it is called Secchi depth. And that's usually about where, you know, grasses need light. So here we are. This is the bay-wide information for those three boxes. Here's what's happening with Lower Eastern Shore, Lower Western Shore, and Tangier. And essentially, your eye picks up that here we were bay-wide and Lower Eastern Shore with Secchi of around between 1.7 and 2 meters. That means that's a lot of light getting down to the bottom. And where we are today in some of these sections, here's the bay, we're about half a meter less. Here we're almost a meter less from where we were. And again, here's the Lower Western Shore and then Tangier. The bottom line is, again, what's happening in the bay is we're losing light. And despite all of the efforts to try to clean up the bay for SAV underwater grasses, we're losing light, we're losing bay grasses. So again, when you, let me put this in another way. This is a reverse way of looking at the light data, in that, as I mentioned before, these underwater grasses need a lot of light. They actually need more light than any living plant on the surface of the earth. Believe it or not, that's hard to believe. But yes, these plants need more light than any other living plant on the surface of the earth. And so what we calculated from that Secchi depth is 22% light is really what these plants need. This is when sunlight hits the surface, it degrades, but they need about 22% of that at depth. So back when we first started monitoring for both the bay, Lower Eastern Shore, Western Shore, this is the amount of light that was reaching 2 meters back in 84. Here it is in for Lower Eastern Shore. And as you saw in the Secchi depth, when we converted all that to the amount of light, 22% reaching the bottom, it's now a little less than a meter and a half bay-wide, but for the West Eastern Shore, and again, these slides are more appropriate here. In 84, it was at 2 meters. We're now at a meter and a half. So we're losing all this light. And, of course, you see a lot of ups and downs through here. But the overall trend is something that concerns us, is that we're losing light. The amount of light reaching these depths, which is why we're losing deep-water grasses, is that it's just not getting enough light. And so, again, when you look at what's happening here, again, here we are with the deep water grasses and the grasses occurring mid-depth, we are seeing far less grasses in these deeper depths. The shallower areas, because it's shallow, you're getting enough light, doesn't seem to move that much along. These lights are pretty much as stable. But we are losing these deep grasses, which, again, when you think about the habitat that blue crabs really need, this is a concern. And I know this comes up repeatedly in a number of discussions, but this is something that really concerns us. Now, keep this in mind when I bring up the latter part of the talk that has to do with our work on the Virginia seaside bays, where things are very, very dramatically different in terms of what's happening with seagrass there. So this kind of concludes the part of the talk on the bay-wide status, but don't lose sight of what's happening here when I bring up what's happening with grasses on the seaside. Now, the next few topics are topics that have come up with regard to interactions that we have with disturbances within the seagrass bed. So the first thing I'm going to touch upon here is what's called the Chincoteague Bay SAB Sanctuary. Now, these are things that we have worked with commission staff and the watermen to try to resolve issues that were impacting underwater grasses. So in Chincoteague Bay, back in the 90s, we saw, and this is an aerial photograph, with all this grass that's in dark with these little white crop circles. What we determined is that it was caused by boats that were pulling these big dredges that were digging up clams and removing the eelgrass. We spent a lot of time working with the commission staff and the watermen to come up with a way of how do we protect the grass beds because they're important. And through a lot of meetings, and the final outcome was we came up with a sanctuary that protected the grass beds only from crab and clam dredging. You know, you could scrape, you can do anything else you want, but the idea was let's protect these grass beds in this area that's in green with a little bit of a buffer. And so what happened was here are the data from when we started looking at the big numbers of scars. We actually established a sanctuary in 1997, but we didn't mark it, and we still found that there were problems, so we actually marked these boundaries. And since 2001, we really didn't have any until last year. And so last year was an interesting year in which this is what we saw. Now, this is greenbackville. I don't know how many of you know about Chincoteague Bay, but the boundary line for Virginia and Maryland is like right through here. So there's a launch ramp, and this area here is part of that sanctuary that I showed you. And here are these scars that we saw right here coming out of that. Now, you don't see any bay grasses, but they are there because it's a system that's recovering, which, again, having these scars would prevent that recruitment. So we have a concern that, you know, someone has gone out, is in the sanctuary, and this is really an enforcement issue that we've already mentioned to VMRC. Now, these scars were caused sometime in the winter of 12, late December 12 and 13, because clam dredging is only allowed, I think, between December and March. So this occurs in the winter, and when we do our mapping, our flyover, we usually collect the information in May, so this is why we see these things. And again, this is the first time we've seen this many scars since we basically developed the sanctuary with marking. So again, this is something that I just want to make you aware. We will work with the staff and enforcement to figure out, you know, how we can prevent this. Now, there's not a lot of people out there that do this clam dredging. This is a process that requires a boat to go in circles and uses a lot of gas. Most people that have done this have moved from the industry, and really it's aquaculture that has taken over. So this is probably caused by one individual. And I guess this is something that, again, just to make you aware that, and I'll work with the staff, hopefully we can resolve this and figure out who's doing this. And right now, of course, it's probably happening again, but if we can alert the enforcement people to what's going on, maybe they can keep their eyes on it. Okay. Next thing is propeller scarring. One of the things that we've seen a lot of grass beds are these white lines that go through these grass beds. These are caused by propellers that dig up the grass. And most of these scars, based on the work that we did way back, were caused by propellers from the people who were fishing using haul stings. Now, again, that was resolved. We came up with a way of resolving it. But let me give you what's happening. So we looked at a lot of the scars, where they were occurring, and we've been watching the scars in two big areas, Browns Bay, which is at the mouth of the York River, into the object, this white box, and in the Pocosin area. And again, we use our aerial photography to follow what's happening. So, for example, this is a picture looking through the belly of a plane into the Browns Bay area in 1997 when the scarring was really bad. And so at 12,000 feet, we can see here's the grass bed all in here with these white lines all being gone from the offshore to the inshore is the way they haul this. And, of course, with their boats, they're pretty big. When they go in at low tide or mid tide, they cut up all the grass and kill it. So, again, we worked with the commission and the watermen to figure out what do we do. You know, we certainly realized this was the livelihood of a number of individuals, and we tried to work with them to come up with a compromise that would hopefully allow them to continue hauling in these areas. And they can't haul everywhere. There are only certain places in the bay where they haul because they can't have obstructions. And so that's why we see scarring occurring in only a few areas. So, okay, from our mapping, let me just go through this very slowly. Each year we measure how many of those scars we see. What's the linear length? So let's say in 1994 we measured almost 100,000 linear meters of scarring in this grass bed. But the most fascinating thing about following the scars, which again came from our aerial photography, which blew us away, is how quickly these scars recover. So here we had 100,000 scars, maybe 95,000 in that year. Follow that line all the way down to the next box. And that meant that between the year that we mapped them and the next year when we looked for those scars, all those scars you couldn't see anymore because the grasses had grown through. It's because these grasses in these bay grow really fast. I mean, they're almost like weeds, which is great. And so by looking at every single year, and this is how we do it, we look at all of our photographs that we collect, look at them and measure the scars. And, of course, this was the time period that really brought to light the problem. We raised this issue with the commissioner and the commission staff. We had lots of meetings with the staff and the watermen, and we had quite an interesting and very challenging discussion about what to do. Some people thought we should close the whole area to prevent this. We said, no, let's step back and realize that now that we know that these areas recover, maybe we can modify the way individuals haul things. So during this time, we said, okay, you know, and this is when we actually started meeting. And as you can see, based on what we did with the watermen and the staff and modifying their haul staining, the number of scars that we saw was reduced dramatically. And again, with a lot of, without minimizing or without without having a lot of regulations, just kind of some compromises. And we did have some things that talked about how they would haul whatever. But this was the Browns Bay area. And again, you can see that since that time, you know, this would be what we would see in 1 year. Now it's down to almost nothing. And I kind of highlighted just this general term because we still see some, this a small amount compared to what we saw earlier. So that's the Browns Bay. That's the Mojack Bay. Here's the Pecosin Flats, in which we saw, again, lots of scarring. And, again, here's that time period that we worked with the watermen and the commission staff to look at how do we resolve this. And, again, a dramatic reduction in the number of scars. Again, the same thing, you know, here's the scar 1 year, and here they are the next year. Again, rapid recovery. And I think that's what was the tipping point of allowing us to say, okay, wait, I don't think we need to close a lot. Let's just work with the watermen to modify their fishing technique. Let's minimize the number of regulations. We don't need lots of things. And I think it's worked really well. But again, I still think it requires us to watch every year, you know, because what we don't want is this to happen again. And I think by us, by them knowing that we're watching them, I think they're pretty careful. Now, I enhanced this little area because we actually saw a little more in 2012. But I still think, given how we see the rate of recovery, I don't think it's an issue that we need to be really concerned about. But if we saw this, we would be obviously getting back to you very quickly. But the fact that since we brought this issue up with the commission and we resolved this through a lot of meetings, and I can say it was very heated at times because, again, there were some people that wanted to close it, and we said, let's get the data first. And our data basically said, we don't need to close it because the grass beds are recovering, will allow them to work. So that whole issue has been resolved. But again, because we need to follow it, we need to at least keep people aware that we're watching. Here's another site in the York River. Now, the VIMS and along with a lot of other people have been trying to restore bay grasses. And this is an area that we have been doing some work off the Coast Guard here in the York River. And these are plots of eelgrass that we planted in 09. You can see all these lines to it because it's an area where haul centers like to go because there's not a lot of obstructions and they're apparently are very successful. So we brought this up, you know, to the commission, and the watermen were, you know, concerned because they didn't want to be locked out of an area where they couldn't haul. So we said, okay, what do we do to minimize the impact in areas where we're trying to restore? So what we agreed upon was to put a series of poles in that area. Now, this is the Coast Guard Pier. This is Wormley Creek. This is the mouth of the York River here. And we said, okay, let's put a series of poles that would guide the haul centers when they bring their nets in straight along, and that they would minimize the disturbance to this area so that, okay, we're going to lose some habitat, but not a lot compared to what would happen if they just had the whole area. Now, the way the nets are pulled in, you have one boat pulling a net here and another over here. lot of our restoration work is going on over here, and there's going to be some recovery here, but we're going to minimize the disturbance. What happened this past year, here's that pole, and you can see while there was one single line over here that somebody didn't pay attention, most of the lines are in the appropriate place. So there's these big white poles. When these guys haul sand at night, they follow those poles, and so we've been pretty pleased that this has worked without us, again, having to do a lot of regulations. I talk every year with a gentleman that kind of oversees the watermen in that area, and we sit down and just talk about it at his house, and it seems to work very well when he realizes we're not trying to close them down. We just want to make them aware of how important these underwater grasses are and that we want them to recover. Okay, the next issue are aquaculture issues. One of the things that I know there's been a lot of interest is the aquaculture of the hard clams. It's a very important industry. It provides lots of jobs, lots of income. They like to be in the same area as eelgrass, and so we have a conflict. Again, this is something that VIMS worked with the staff and the industry to come up with this regulation that basically says no new structures are allowed in areas where there's existing underwater grasses. So part of what we do in VIMS, when they get permits that are in areas of grass, we look at our aerial photographs, we try to work out compromises with people that would like to have aquaculture, and sometimes they can't get what they want, but we try to deal with some issues that allow people to do aquaculture in and around areas that have SAV, and I work with Hank and the staff here. That seems to work. Now, we had a problem a couple years ago. This is, again, from an aerial photograph, and here's this nice big grass bed, and one day we said, whoa, what is this? And we saw all these rectangular plots that were occurring in eelgrass. We worked with the staff and the enforcement people, and while this individual had lots of clams, we could have made the guy take his clams out because he disobeyed the rule. We said, let's step back. Let's wait a minute. We know that this is going to be an economic hardship and a pain in the neck for the guy to get all his clams out. So we worked out a deal, and we said, let's wait until the gentleman takes all his clams out, and then we'll be okay. And the deal was they would help us collect seeds to reseed the area when they were going to remove the clams. That was supposed to be last year. It took them a while to get the clams out. They're now all out, and we'll work with them again to try to harvest some seeds and reseed it. Now, some of this may have gotten reseeded by itself from all these grass beds which we see, but again, what I want to point out is that I think VIMS and the staff have tried to be very understanding of the nature of this industry and make these people realize, hey, be very careful about where you work, but when it happens, we try to be understanding. But I think they're kind of getting the message that, you know, these areas are very important for a lot of other things, notably blue crabs. Okay, the part that I really want to highlight, and this is really important, remembering what I talked about with regard to the eelgrass in the Chesapeake Bay. We have been working in the seaside lagoons for quite a while where historically, and let me go through this cartoon, this is where eelgrass was in 1930, this big cartoon with a lot of pink in it. These were all the grass beds were in 1930. In the 60s, because we lost a lot of eelgrass in the 30s due to a disease and a storm, eelgrass did recover really well in the Chesapeake Bay. It recovered in Chincoteague, but we never saw any recovery in these coastal bays in the 60s. And that was through 1997. Again, nothing. But in 1997, we began an effort to try to restore grass because we had gotten information that there was a patch of grass in these bays. And we said, okay, cool. So we basically said, let's see what we can do about restoring grass. We started with small patches and began to work here's this part of the seaside where we are doing a restoration work. There were four bays in the study site we call South Bay. These are all these coastal lagoons that are protected by these barrier islands. So we have what I'm going to refer to as South Bay, Cobb Bay, Spider Crab Bay, and Hog Island Bay. We've been doing a lot of work, which includes not just putting plants out, but we also monitor the water quality because it's really important to know if they're successful, well, what are the water quality conditions, so we compare that to the Chesapeake Bay, and if they're not, well, what's going on? So we do a lot of very sophisticated water quality work with sending boats around following this little stream, this line, dark line, collecting data. We also have what are called fixed water quality stations. We have an operation where we collect water quality data that's telemetered to us at VIMS. But the big picture is this. Okay, so what we've been doing is using a seed-based restoration program where we actually use some volunteers, and we literally just broadcast seeds out into these areas because we now know a lot more of why eelgrass never return there. They're isolated. The likelihood of seeds getting there were pretty low, so we figured, okay, let's put seeds out. And what's happened is, here we are, from when we started the work in 1998 through 2012, we have seeded roughly 370 acres with about 50 million seeds. And today, from our mapping, we have about 4,700 acres of grass that have recovered to these areas because the plants spread naturally. They produce seeds. And so this, by far, is probably one of the most successful eelgrass restoration projects in the world. No one really has ever seen what we've seen in the coastal bays in such a short time period. So think about what's been happening in the Chesapeake, and here we are in the Seaside Bay seeing the exact reverse. And what's been happening, of course, is that these bays are next to the ocean. They receive much clearer, cleaner, cooler water, and it is cooler than the Chesapeake Bay. And so the conditions are just right for eelgrass to grow. Unlike in the Chesapeake Bay, where it's getting hotter and the water quality is declining, our water quality in the Seaside Bays is significantly better. I'm going to walk you through this because this is pretty important because it plays into what's going to happen at the end of my talk in terms of the bigger picture of the seaside. So here are the four bays that we're working in: South Bay, Cobb Bay, Spider Crab, and Hog Island Bay. South Bay is the place we worked first. These circles represent each year that we put a certain number of seeds in a certain number of plots. So in South Bay, we started doing large-scale restoration in 99, and we did that all the way through about 2005 and stopped, and then didn't add any more seeds into South Bay. So what you see between here and here is all of the natural recovery that is occurring based on us just putting a few seeds in. Now, a few meaning about 5 million. But the fact is that these seeds establish, the plants grow, they produce their own flowering shoots, and in South Bay, we've kind of leveled off. And actually, these dark bars and light bars represent the amount of grass in areas. So the darker the bar, the more continuous the coverage. The lighter bar, the less coverage. So what you have is a bed that starts out real patchy, and over those 5 or 6 years, that bed is now almost 100% continuous coverage. Now, in Cobb Bay, it's the same thing. We didn't do a lot of seeding, but Cobb Bay, you know, we're asymptoting out, so we're almost at the level of where I think we've got maybe a few more acres that would be able to recover. Spider Crab Bay is an interesting bay in that we've done a lot more seeding, and it's recovering a little more slowly. Spider Crab has an interesting story in that there's some water that's some bottom that's very deep, and it's got a very different sediment type, but we are seeing essentially a slow recovery and increase over the last few years, even though we're putting a lot more seeds out. Hog Island Bay is another story in which this is one we seeded with these plots, and it's also asymptoting out. It's getting a little thicker, but we've actually lost some grass in Hog Island Bay. And some things about Hog Island Bay, it's a wide open system. We think there's a water clarity issue happening in Hog Island Bay, but that's another big story. But I want to key in on South Bay and Cobb Bay and Spider Crab Bay because with regard to the part of the talk that I want to bring in the bay scallop work, these bays are going to be really relevant to the bay scallop restoration. Now, one thing about water quality, and again, I showed this slide last year. This is what we call a YSI that is on a post, and this basically sends us water clarity data, water quality data. So every 15 minutes, it collects lots of information, and it sends us that data immediately. So I could call up right now and tell you what the temperature of the water is in South Bay. I can tell you how much chlorophyll there is. I can tell you how turbid it is. It's a pretty impressive piece of equipment. It costs about $20,000, but we can basically see what's happening in South Bay at any 15-minute period. Now, we have these in the Chesapeake, and we've been comparing what happens in the Chesapeake with the coastal bays, and it's very enlightening and is helping us to work with the managers to say, you know, if you want to get grass back into the Chesapeake, let's look at what's happened at these seaside bays. These seaside bays are absolutely crucial in our management strategy, especially with the bay managers trying to figure out how do we get more bay grasses back. But this basically tells the story. Turbidity, that is how clear the water is, the higher the number, the dirtier the water. And what happened over 2006 through 2012, as that bed expanded, the water got much clearer, and these lines basically represent ranges. So at sometimes the water is so turbid you can't even see, but if you look at back in 2012, that range is much less. So what's happening as the bed expands, the beds obviously clean the water off, and this is one of the features, what they call ecosystem services, of grass beds. As the beds get larger and larger, the clarity of the water improves dramatically. And that's what's really neat, is that, you know, we were talking about water clarity, but it's sort of like the chicken and the egg. You need a little bit of clear water first before you get the grass bed. But as these beds expand, and if they're not challenged by bad conditions like what we're seeing in the Chesapeake, they just take off on their own. So that's an important component that we're now trying to work with the bay managers, especially as they now talk about these impending stormwater regulations that many communities will have to deal with because they want to clean up the bay. Okay, trying to wrap up, bay scallops. This is really the next step and actually the really coolest part of this besides the fact that eelgrass is recovering. Back in the 30s, there was a very important commercial fishery of bay scallops in Accomack and North Hampton County. So in 1925 through 1932, these are the pounds of scallops harvested and the dollars and what they would equal in today's dollars. After eelgrass declined and basically was lost in 33, they never harvested any more bay scallops. Bay scallops live a couple years, but believe it or not, they really require eelgrass to settle on as little babies. So when they float around the water column, when they're ready to settle, they've got to have eelgrass. And once eelgrass declined and was lost, even though there might have been some bay scallops, there was not the habitat they needed to survive. So with no eelgrass returning, we never saw any fishery return. That's changing because in 2009, we initiated a bay scallop restoration effort through Mark Lukenbach and Eastern Shore. And what they do is they, you know, spawn bay scallops in the lab, and then they take these bay scallops at the small size, we put them in these cages, and we put these cages out into the field so that as they grow, when they're ready to spawn, all little babies will spread, you know, through these different bays and produce scallops that I guess our goal is to hopefully see where this may go in developing perhaps a commercial fishery that might be sustainable and provide some sort of economic support for that particular area. Plus, people like scallops, as I do. Now, how do we determine how successful we are? And this is a huge effort. So what we do, you know, Mark puts out these cages, the scallops spawn, they go out into the grass beds. And so we do two different ways of looking at the bay scallops. We put out what's called a drop net with a vacuum cleaner. It's a suction dredge. And we use that over small areas to collect the small bay scallops. And then for the larger ones, we put people in the water and literally feel for the bay scallops. So the only way you can find the scallops that are about 20 millimeters or not quite an inch is you got to basically put your face in the water and feel every square inch of bottom in plots like this. And we did that in 2012 and 13. And again, let me just kind of give you a big picture. So this big box that's outlined in red is about 1,000 acres of eelgrass behind Wreck Island. This is South Bay. So all this dark area is this nice, really dense, absolutely beautiful, wonderful grass bed, which bay scallops like. We put all these bay scallops in cages and went out in 2012, and these ellipses basically show where we found bay scallops. So we found a lot, and we estimated there were 2 million bay scallops in this grass bed that year. Now, in 2013, it was a little different story, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to work you through this table because this is probably one of the most crucial tables that we have that will tell us whether this whole thing is going to work. So here are the larvae that Mark has produced in his lab. Again, he spawns these bay scallops. So in 2009, 1.4, 10.4, and 2010, 3.7. Now, there's a lot of issues in trying to raise bay scallops in the lab. These are what we put in terms of thousands of bay scallops in these plots. So in 2010, we put only 6,000 in these cages, 2011, 76. We lost a lot of bay scallops. If you see this notation here, there was poor survival associated with low cold weather and low salinity, so much less in 2012 and 125,000 in 2013. Now, what does this relate to in terms of the scallops that we harvested? So in 2011, we had 76,000 scallops in cages. We came up with an assessment of around 2 million scallops in that grass bed. That year of 2012, we had a little less than half and only 200,000 scallops. What happens this year in 2013, where we'll sample in 2014, if this holds, we should see many more than we saw here, primarily because it's a numbers game. The more scallops, adult scallops you put out, the more larvae they produce, and voila, more adults. So we're hoping that if we do see that, it'll provide strong evidence that it's a numbers game. We want to get bay scallops out to where they were as a commercial fishery. We'll want to get more bay scallops. Now, we do have a pending grant which was approved with the U.S. Army Corps to basically ramp up this effort. We're working with the Corps to come up with the right language and the requirements. But if we do, along with the money that we get from the Recreational Fishing License Fund and the Virginia Coastal Program, we're excited about the opportunity to really expand that and see if we can indeed get this to where we would be able to even talk about the possibility of a commercial fishery. So now what does this have to do with the next slide? Now, again, please pay attention because this is going to be a really interesting one. Here we are. This is the Delmarva Peninsula. This is the Virginia portion. Here's the Virginia-Maryland line up here. On this slide, there are several things I want you to note. The bailer grounds. These are all the public grounds that are available to anyone who wants to work. And you can see in this purple area, lots of polygons that are purple. Again, there are private leases. These are the leases that individuals rent from VMRC and pay an annual rental fee. And you can see there are some up here and here and over here. And I'm going to enlarge this in a couple of seconds. And then what's our current eelgrass coverage in these bays? Now, the reason why we're highlighting these, of course, is because this was the prime bay scallop area. This is where all the grass beds were. When you go and you find out from the old timers, this is where it all happened. And that's why we're highlighting this area. The areas that we have had approval from VMRC, the commission, and areas that are allowed to, for the eelgrass to be allowed to kind of grow and not have to be leased out, are two sites. This is Hog Island Bay, and this is South Bay. You see a big box up here in Chincoteague. I just want to highlight that's the sanctuary area that we set up back in early 2000, and that is an area that, again, only is for preventing clam and crab dredging. But the nature of what we are concerned about is this area here, because we assume we'd like to see bay scallops back, and people would like to see that. So let's look at the areas that we have, because it's a numbers game. So if you look at that area from Wallops all the way down to the tip of the Delmarva Peninsula in Virginia, there are about 129,000 acres of open area, open water. That is divided among bottom that's unassigned, that is areas that are currently not leased but available for leasing. We have the bailer grounds. These are the public grounds that are 45,000 acres. And then there are currently about 15,500 acres that are leased. And here are the percentages. So the biggest portion of unassigned bottom is 53%. Now, that number is a little misleading because there's a lot of this bottom that's channels, very sandy area, open area, that probably will never get leased. So when you say unassigned, probably there's some percentage that would never, ever be leased, because someone who is in aquaculture will never want to put their clams in an area that's going to get covered over by sand. And there's a lot of sand movement over there. I don't know how many of you know something about that area, but there's a lot of sand movement. So when you look at this total here, this 128, we have our current eelgrass restoration. There's approximately 4,600 acres that's embedded in unassigned bailer ground and actually covers some of the private leases. So let's look at the next picture, because this is important in relation to what we would like to see happen in these two bays, because this is where we think the bay scallops are going to be really important. So we have, spider crab, and we call this Cobb Bay, here South Bay. So the bailer grounds are in these hash mark purple. The yellow lines are areas that are currently leased by individuals. The lightest green, and as you see here, are areas that currently have grass. And then the darkest green areas are areas that we said, okay, where are the areas that maybe eelgrass possibly can expand to? Now, that doesn't mean it's going to, but we took a kind of a guesstimate and drew a box around where eelgrass might expand in the future. And it may not happen because there's a lot of things that go on in these areas that that may prevent it. But we said, okay, if we look at Spider Crab Bay, this dark greenish area is probably potentially eelgrass. Now, there is, as I said, a big area in here that's deep water. It may never see eelgrass. But as eelgrass improves water clarity, we may possibly see more eelgrass in this area. South Bay, most of the eelgrass potential area is actually in bailer grounds. And it's open area. While you see some leases in here, and like this lease here where there's already existing grass, some of these leases are probably old leases from people who wanted to do clamming. And the type of clamming that I was referring to with these big dredges doesn't really happen that much. So one of the things that, you know, we've been discussing is the possibility of having more area that we could provide some protection to that are in unassigned bottoms that maybe VMRC would be willing to commit to. And we're talking about, you know, these potential areas or even in the areas that are not in this, what we call the set-aside that VMRC has given to VIMS to do their work. And I kind of want to leave that open maybe for discussion as to what we can do there. So that's just something to think about when we come back to this figure. But if we're really truly interested in trying to get the base scallops, I mean, it would be a feat that no one has ever been able to accomplish anywhere that we know of actually bringing a fishery back from where it was abundant, completely disappeared. It would be truly a feat that I think would be kind of fun to work with the commission to figure out how do we get a commercial fishery back. So with that, let me just do some quick summaries and we can get into some discussion. The water quality issue, you know, I've said this every year, for eelgrass and other SAVs is a major issue. You all are going to hear about this a lot. You know, if you're in any of these rural communities, you know, you're going to hear about stormwater regulations that are going to be implemented effective July 1st. They're really relevant because they're the ones that could be an important step in improving water clarity. We are concerned about what's happening with eelgrass given the 2012 numbers and what we have now looked at in detail about these areas that are deeper water. Will they ever recover? I would say that if you improve water clarity, you clean it up, they will come because they produce lots of seeds. We've seen in years when the water clarity improves. And if you recall the variation in the clarity, that those years where water clarity improves, these grass beds have a lot of resilience. They recover very fast, just like I pointed out in the work that we're doing with the propeller scarring. We're actually awed at the fact these plants recover fast. So if they improve water clarity, we would expect that these beds could recover. But water clarity, water quality is the number one issue for SAV in the Chesapeake Bay. The Chincoteague Bay stuff, again, I'd like to at least work with the commission and their enforcement people to highlight the fact that things are going on back again, and there's probably one or two individuals, maybe kind of a one-on-one talk saying, hey, you know, what we don't want to do is close it. I mean, that came up in our discussion. What if we just close it? Well, we don't want to do that. We don't like saying no because we know no means brings up a lot of negative connotations. So we've always tried to work with the watermen and the staff to come up with compromises. But we've always said, hey, you know, if you don't want to follow this, you know, we can do this. So I'd like to maybe suggest that the enforcement people touch base with some of the people and let them know what's happened. Repeller scarring, again, we got to monitor this because, again, by being the eye in the sky, and there are some people that, again, I talk to regularly. You know, we have kind of a nice conversation once a year and just let them know what's going on. I think that helps, but again, it's the same thing. We want to watch this every year because we don't want this to begin to get out of hand, and so our monitoring is really important. The aquaculture issues, they're challenging, but again, like anything else, we're working with the commission staff for compromises to figure out how do we protect grass, but we know the importance of aquaculture as an economic driver for many localities. The coastal bays, man, it's fantastic. I mean, for someone like me who's been in this business for 40-some years, to see what's happening in the Chesapeake Bay, and then all of a sudden, you know, in 10 years, see something go from nothing to over 4,500 acres in about a decade, is encouraging and promising and allows us to really hit home how important water clarity is. And, of course, for base scallops, you know, again, with my annual presentation, we'll keep you abreast of that. You know, we're hopeful. You know, we've proof of concept that it does work. If you put scallops out, you'll get bay scallops, but it's a numbers game. And for our discussion, would we want to consider protecting more areas? And, you know, that's kind of a dicey thing because I don't want, you know, the aquaculture people to think we're taking over and getting more land. But if you recall from that table, there's probably going to be the maximum of all that bottom 10% that might have risk. It may not even be 10%. But I don't want this to be assumed that we're just going to take over the bottom. I've had a good working relationship with the commission, with the staff, and coming up with ways that are reasonable, areas that I don't think would be good for aquaculture because aquaculture usually goes into shallower areas where you don't find eelgrass. There may be some way of compromises, but I think that's something that we need to have a conversation, not just with you, but the commission staff and some of the aquaculture people. And some of the actions we're going to need from you are monitoring for scarring, and the scars and chicotee come from some of the funding from the commercial license, so we need you to approve that grant again. We get that every year, and we do all of our work for that scarring during the summer, so we need that approval from you. We need your support. We get our funding for the seaside work from your recreational fishing license fund. We've got a great relationship with them. They're very supportive of us. The Virginia Coastal Program has been a great supporter, funding this work every year. And again, with this new grant, we're trying to work with the Army Corps to work out the language. The last part I do want to highlight, you know, as with all monitoring programs, people sometimes say, why do you got to continue monitoring? We are seeing a big reduction in monitoring funds. I am very concerned that the work that we've been doing and providing information, we are in serious jeopardy of maybe losing the monitoring program. All of the big, you know, the sequestration, everything has led to people that have grant authority, and the possibility of maybe getting some more state funds, which we get very little of. All this work that we do, believe it or not, there's very little state money that goes into this. And so I'm hoping that maybe we could at least encourage, you know, some people to support this at the state level. And with that, I know it's a lot. It took a long time, but I felt that these issues, because of the fact that, you know, SAV is a huge issue in the Bay, we're using it as the barometer of the health of the Bay, one of these things that you all need to be really kept informed, and that's why I like to make these annual presentations. And again, trying to emphasize that in areas where we have some disturbance, we try to work it out where we don't say no, but we try to, again, encourage and educate people about the importance of this particular habitat. And with that, I think that's pretty much it, and I'll open the floor to any questions from the commission.
Kathy, can we have your mic, please?
And I know that took a little bit longer, but since I was...
It was very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Yeah, Rick.
I mean, each one of these little things could take... I mean, I like to talk about grass all the time. And it could be a lot longer, but I try to highlight the important issues and the answer to some new people. I apologize for the older people. I mean, the older people here that these issues. I didn't mean older. I mean, anyway. So, questions.
Thank you, Dr. Orr. Commission, do you have any questions? Mr. Plummer.
It's
go ahead.
Well, I appreciated the presentation and thought I was very impressed with the efforts and, well, the data that you showed about regrowth and your ability to work with the industry and the commission to bring about a lot of the changes that you went through. And it seemed to me the bottom line is, what can the VMRC do to improve light on the bottom and water clarity and protect the grasses?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, other than the funding request that you came up with at the end and the summary, have you ever been asked to go and, like, create the five top recommendations for the VMRC to consider in trying to improve those things?
Mm-hmm.
To present.
Well, the water quality issue is beyond your control. This
right.
is something that comes through DEQ. When the Bay Program was established in the 1970s, a lot of the regulations that were put into place controlled point sources. That's been really easy to tackle. It's very easy to stop what comes from a pipe. The biggest issue are the non-point sources, the stuff that comes from runoff. Effective July 1st, DEQ because of the emphasis on the bay and the regulations that are being imposed by EPA, effective July 1st, there are these whole new set of stormwater regulations that every single community is going to have to implement. And people are screaming because there is an economic impact to the communities that I know in my community, a discussion going on about what it might mean for a small business. But the problem is that we all contribute to this in terms of stormwater runoff, whether we have a one-acre lot, a five-acre lot, whether we have a small business or a big business, it's the runoff issues, and it's going to become costly. But with regard to what the commission can do, certainly in terms of, one, just the awareness, and when you work with your delegates and senators with regard to the issues of water quality, that's going to be probably the key thing. I don't think you can pass anything or have a regulation. That's not in your domain, so you can't do much about that. I think just, understanding what the issues are and that, as we come to issues that require some compromises is to, say, okay, how do we protect the areas that we have eelgrass? How do we consider areas that used to have eelgrass that no longer have that could be? Someone says, there hasn't been grass here in 20 years. What's the likelihood of it? And that's where it gets dicey because it requires us to think, okay, will there ever be eelgrass? Let's say back in the Rappahannock River, there's almost nothing. But yet back in the 60s, huge beds of eelgrass. A lot of bare bottom, but we haven't seen grass there since 72. So, again, I think it's going to be, let's kind of put on the table the idea that, again, you do have regulations about aquaculture. You have regulations that deal with, protecting some areas. So I think, if anything, those are things to really stay on top of.
Well, it seems like we can, in reducing cover, reducing turbidity, we can help with water quality. Protecting the eelgrass, you can improve water quality. We look at items like winter crab dredge and, mm-hmm. other things that may affect bottom. And, it seems to me that, there are limitations on what we could do. We don't have anything to do with MS4 permits and all of the things that are coming.
Now, the crab dredging, winter crab dredging, let me make this clear. The winter crab dredging that now is on hold in no way, shape, or form ever impacted an area with grass. Some people will comment, oh, these people went out and dug up all this grass. Well, all the crab dredging in the winter occurs in deep water and doesn't even go near grass beds. The crab scraping that does occur, by people, doesn't really disturb the grass. It's the propellers that really do more damage. And those people know that. We've heard people say, all these guys scrape up and they have all this grass that floats around. Most of the grass that comes up in these crab scrapes are grasses that are starting to die back anyway. So, we are watching what's going on within the bay for all these particular fishing techniques. And what we see overall, again, is it's water quality, water quality, water quality, over and over.
Thank you.
Mr. Packer.
Two questions. First, but I would like to say thank you for all your work. I definitely think that you do a great job. You're a great, you have great leadership in this area. You've worked, as I understand, very well with industry, mm-hmm. particularly with aquaculture.
There are some people that may not like us because they
sure.
don't like grass.
Sure. No, you can't do everything to please everybody, right. But and by and large, you've done a great job, and I have to say I think without you, this probably wouldn't have happened. And I appreciate it. I know there's some funding that's come. I see Ms. McKay back there. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank all who have funded this. It's a neat thing to see. I live on the mainland, right in the zone. So it reminds me of my childhood in Nassauwatis Creek. And that brings me to my question. Have you tried any of this kind of work in some of the Bayside Creeks? So it used to be you saw the same type of grass and some of the creeks on the eastern shore.
We have probably done since 1977 restoration work in probably every conceivable area of the bay. I've got a graphic that shows where we've done it. In some areas, they do well for a few years and they die. Believe it or not, one of the most successful areas that we've had within the Chesapeake Bay, you're not going to believe this, is the James River, right out here in front between the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel and the Monitor Merrimack. We did some work that was funded by the Recreational Fishing License Fund, and we did some restoration work at both ends near the Monitor Merrimack and the James River. And those grass beds have spread and continue to grow. And while we've seen declines in other areas, it's been striking how well they've done. Now, the reason why, if you think about the location of the James River, It's very close to the mouth of the bay, and when the tide floods, you've got this nice cool water coming in and comes up along that shore, the north shore, and it's really clear water. And then when the tide ebbs, if you know something about that point that sticks out by the Monterey Merrimack, all the water gets shunted out off that side and doesn't need that dirty water that comes from the upper James River doesn't even impinge on that. So you've got this almost like a distinct water body in the James. So again, you know, we know what it takes to get the grass beds back, but we've done work in many areas of the Rappahannock and the York that we consider marginal for growth, and they do okay maybe 1 or 2 years, sometimes not, and then they die. Because, you know, we see again some good years where it's less rain, less runoff, maybe not as hot, and that's another issue, the heat issue. We've had a couple bad years in 2005 and 2010 when we had significantly higher temperatures. I failed to mention that. And actually, that's one of the things that happened in Spider Crab Bay, because seedlings, the little babies, when they develop, are much more sensitive to heat. The adult plants aren't, because in the coastal bays, when you look at the temperature of the water, every 6 hours, that water from the ocean comes in and bathes these coastal bays with nice, clear water. The little babies, the seedlings, don't like hot water. And so when we had hot summers, the babies died, but the adults survived. In the Chesapeake Bay, it's a very different story, because the farther you are away from the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, the farther you away from this influence of this cold water. So in places that don't get this nice cool water, whenever we have these two hot summers, we've seen big diebacks. So, yes, we've tried in many, many areas. We continue to do that. You know, we continue to try to use these plants like these sentinels. I mean, they're like the canary in the cage. We can plant. If they don't live, we know the conditions are not that good. But we also, by looking at what's happened in every region, we can tell you whether if you planted it would survive, because we watch the come and go of grasses in every single area. I mean, we know where every leaf is. And we do a lot of on-the-ground work, too. So based on that, you know, when people ask me, well, can I transplant in my area, like a young woman called me, my parents want to plant grass in their front yard. I said, well, where do you live? And they gave me the creek, and I said, you could try, but it's not going to survive, because we've already been seeing, you know, a change on the negative side. So some people don't like me telling them that, but I try to be as honest as I can so that they understand the nature of what's happening in the Chesapeake Bay. So, yeah, I mean, we try.
Thank you.
Dr. Torres, thank you for your work. And
you the action item of,
yep.
Can I get some of the commercial? And the other thing is, you know, what kind of discussion can we have about some of these, like, South Bay areas that are outside our set of sires? I mean, how would you like to approach that? Because this is something that, you know, we can say, oh, let's just cover all this area, but that may not work, and we would obviously need to have a public hearing. So how would you like VIMS and your staff to work and think about how we could approach that and adding to more areas that, you know, we could say, hey, these are areas that, you know, we don't want to lease. Now, one thing that happens in the seaside bays, where there's grass, you wouldn't be able to lease anyway right now. And they're mostly on assigned bottoms. So I just would like some kind of direction. What would you like us to do working with your staff, given that, you know, what's happening in these seaside bays and the fact that we want to get bay scallops back? What would you prefer us to do?
Can you delineate the areas and say Spider Crab Bay and South Bay where you would like additional set aside?
Yeah, now, Spider Crab is really easy because most of Spider Crab Bay is bale ground. You don't got to do much. You don't have to do much in that. It's South Bay where there's a lot of unassigned bottom that if we can say, just let's watch what happens. You know, we can say for, like we've done for these other areas, maybe 5 years or so, let's just see what goes on. Now, you may not even get any requests because there are bottoms that are very deep, and the people that are doing the aquaculture don't like to be in really deep bottoms unless they have to put cages. But that doing cages means above ground, and you're going to have a lot of issues with those and boaters. So it might be that, you know, we could work with your staff, we can work with Laura and come up with, you know, some polygons in the amount of area and just throw it out and see what you all would
and
like
bring
to
it
do.
Back to the commission
yeah.
at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can do that, and, you know, staff can kind of work with you and at some point over the next few months say, okay, here are some scenarios, here are the plots, you know, and let's just see what we have. And, again, to do that would probably require a public hearing because that's how we operated in the previous years.
Right. Well, let me say a couple things. Your work on the in the seaside lagoons is truly impressive, and I really liked how you tantalizingly dangled the concept of a bay scallop fishery commercially again.
It would be, I mean, I don't want to retire yet until I see that happening. I mean, I'm hoping we'll see it just because, I mean, you know, all of us watch things decline. To be on the other side of the coin when things are improving is just phenomenal. And I've said repeatedly, you know, to the Bay managers, look at how things respond when you aren't challenged by water clarity and temperature. It just is, it's truly amazing. These plants are resilient.
Speaking of water quality here, what would your honest assessment be at this point of what we should expect from the new stormwater regulations and their impact on SAB in the Bay?
That is the $64,000 question. Based on all the models and whether the models are correct or not, the expectation is tied with these TMDLs. You know, when you look at those two, the hope is that things will improve and that we will see it. And that's why we need to continue monitoring the Bay grasses, because they respond so quickly. So, you know, we could say it, if it's going to work, we're going to see the response pretty quickly in Bay grasses.
That is the hope. Is that your hope?
Right.
Is that your expectation?
Yes, it is. That, you know, if these things do work and people do recognize that stormwater regulations will help. And again, there's a lot of debate. I mean, right now, in the General Assembly sessions, there are lots of bills that are dealing with the new stormwater regulations, one of which has been introduced by Delegate Hodges, that basically allows communities who are non-MS4 to opt out. And the only reason I tell you this is because some of you know I'm on the Gloucester County Board of Supervisors. I'm actually chair this year.
Oh, boy.
So I'm wearing two very different hats, but recognizing that, you know, from where I stand as a scientist, this is what we need. And the expectations based on the models, it should work. Now, you know, models are only as good as the data that go into it. And so VIMS does have a crew of modelers that are looking at their own models that, you know, hopefully we'll see some changes. But the only way we're really going to get the Bay back to where it was, and it may never be like it was when John Smith was here, but certainly I like to see it where we do have significant grass beds in areas where we don't have any today. And because there is that importance to the blue crab. I mean, there are a lot of things that impact that blue crab. You know, you all deal with that. But you've heard that, you know, the importance of habitat for these juveniles is really crucial. And, you know, Vince has done some really nice work looking at the importance of, you know, these areas because of the way the blue crab, you know, enters the bay as little babies and requires these grass beds to survive and grow until they get big enough that they can move out. So, you know, from the point of view of the blue crab, this is pretty important. And why we think, you know, with all these issues that are happening, you know, I think it's one element in the equation of what happens at the end of the pipeline in terms of the commercial catch.
Thank you. Mr. Sessions.
I've got a question. Being in the development business, this is an interesting conversation. Is it determined that runoff is the main cause of the reduction in clarity? I hear you talk about the importance of clarity for us, for the grasses to grow. And I've heard you talk about the EPA rules coming down. Is that the determination, is that runoff is the main cause for the reduction in water clarity?
The non-point source issues runoff are considered a major one. Now, remembering that, you know, what happens in the atmosphere eventually gets to the ground. And we also have some groundwater issues. But it is, you know, the runoff and what lands on, you know, the land that is the major issue. Now, we've got a developer in our Gloucester County that's been pounding on me, showing me, you know, some of the economic impacts, which, you know, is important for rural communities. There are many, many rural communities that are really looking at this very carefully. But on the other hand, you know, if we don't do something, you know, to deal with the runoff, the bay is just not going to get any better. And they've been, you know, think about where we were in the 70s to where we are today. A lot of voluntary stuff has not worked. The point sources are easy. You know, mitigating the stormwater is going to be really crucial. And that's a complicated, challenging issue. And how quickly it works, you know, no one really knows. But they know that, you know, some of the models show removing, you know, the stormwater runoff, you know, is going to make a difference. I mean, that's what all these models show.
Is it mainly like suspended solids or chemicals running off?
Depends on the region. I mean, you know, places, rural areas like Gloucester is going to be primarily suspended sediment. And when you look at a lot of the data that we get, the biggest issue is dirt, you know, the suspended sediment that's in there. Now, you know, of course, we've lost lots of oysters that provide the filtering capacity. We've lost all the grass beds that have lost that filtering capacity. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of hard work to get the water quality back so that, you know, grass beds come back. You know, oysters do play some role, but not as big as some people would like to think. But it is going to be, you know, creating proper buffer zones, creating, you know, stormwater retention ponds. I mean, for a developer like you, you've got your work cut out for you with these new regulations. But they're there, and there's no way of avoiding it. And this bill that Delegate Hodges has introduced, you know, we've talked to him extensively. He doesn't think that they're going to be delayed, but it's going to allow small communities to opt out of that. But opt out means that the state mandates that were unfunded now go back to DEQ. But MS4 communities like Norfolk, like Virginia Beach, Hampton, Newport News, there will be a cost associated with that, which, again, as a developer, you're going to see those.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Wirth. We got two issues here. We're going to come back with a set-aside at some point here for a public hearing.
Correct.
And now I guess we come to money.
Yeah, it was only $22,000 from the commercial side that allows us to do the actual monitoring of the propeller scars and these other scars. So, you know, it allows us to get do the analysis of the photography, which we get. That's the cheap part. And allows us to actually do some of the groundwork. Yeah. And, okay. You know, that's been approved pretty much when I make my presentation, unless you guys want to do something different.
Mr. Riley.
I understand that's been a split between the two funds, the Marine Fishing Improvement Fund and the Recreational Saltwater Fund.
And even split, as I recall.
Yes.
Correct. So it's a funding request for $22,000 to continue your scarring work?
I move to approve.
We hear a motion. No, I hear a second.
Second.
Second from Mr. Tankard. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Approved.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hope you can finish the meeting before the snow hits.
So do I.